It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Saturday marks 2 weeks since the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, at which 11 worshipers were killed. The horrific event touched all of Pittsburgh and even the nation. We're here in the offices of Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. Mayor, first of all, how are you doing, and how's the city doing?
Well, personally, I'm doing fine. I took a little bit of time off on Election Day when I would have been going to the polls and visiting different parts of the city. I decided to work from home, and it seems to still be giving me a little bit of a respite. The city is still hurting, and, you know, that's the idea of this event on Friday. It's how we can unite together, how we can see some goodness out of the bad, words of inspiration, songs, and prayer, and pulling us all together and reminding us the one simple fact that we are one. And our goal is to be able to do that in an hour and a half, beginning at 12 noon on Friday.
You knew when you were elected, and then again when you were reelected as mayor, what the job entailed, make sure that good people were in place to provide needed services to city residents effectively, help improve the city overall, whatever other definition you'd like to put in there for your job description. But this part of the job, to be a voice for the city at such a sad time, how did this challenge you as a mayor and as a person?
A couple different things. Number one, you never have a debate question that asks, what do you do to console a mother who just lost her son earlier in the day and knows that they will never walk through the door again? And unfortunately, I've had that experience over the past 5 years several times. I've been in homes where life was lost and the blood was still on the walls. So it comes with the job. It never gets easier. And you always hope that you will never be that city that has a mass loss of life. I talked with the mayor of Orlando, Buddy Dwyer, and he referred to it as the committee that no mayor wants to be on. And there is a very, very strong network of mayors that help. Speaking to the mayors of Parkland, the mayor of Boston, when something happens, they call you, and they give sage advice about what to do. The best advice that I got came from the mayor of Oakland, California, Libby Schaff. She had the ghost ship catastrophe where the nightclub caught on fire and so many young people lost their lives. She said, have a plan, stick to that plan, make it transparent, and be honest. And that's it. And our plan became, we take care of the families first. Every family, what they need, they get. We work with those that were injured to make sure that they heal, and we stop this number from going up any higher, working with the hospitals. We then reach out to the greater Jewish community. We let them know that they are loved, and we show them that they are safe with a show of force. And then we reach out to the greater community, and we spread a message of compassion, love, and unity throughout the city. Now as we are entering the end of the second week, a little bit has begun to return to normalcy, a little bit. We're still not quite there as far as operations of the city. We still have our focus on those priorities, but, you know, we still have to pick up the garbage. We still have to patch the potholes. We still have to put out the fires. So we don't get the luxury of choosing one over the other. We just have the ability to create and set priorities.
At the media briefing, the day after the shooting, you said, quote, we are here as a community of one for you. We will get through this darkest day of Pittsburgh history by working together. You've talked about community, about working together. How do you make sure that that sort of spirit of unity continues on as the days go by and, in a sense, we get back to some sense of normalcy?
Well, part of it is in just the basics of communication. I'm a firm believer that hate speech leads to hate crimes. And if you counter hate speech with speech that is more about unity, compassion, and love, then you have an ability to even it out. I think then it becomes based upon actions and working through the city of Pittsburgh, through our neighborhoods, promoting the events that bring cross sectors together, like Rodman Baptist bringing together the Jewish community in order to have a special prayer session, and this Sunday having another one for our police officers, helping to promote that type of activity that is cross-sectional and takes down walls and builds bridges is ultimately the way that we get through this. There isn't another path. Well, there is another path, and that's trying to defeat it with hate. And that is a failed path and one that only leads us further down, not in any way lifts us up.
When the Trump administration announced the president would be visiting Pittsburgh, you said you should wait till after the funerals. So, in a sense, do you have any second thoughts about that opinion or saying, hey, yeah, you're welcome here, but why don't you first really denounce hatred, white supremacy, anti-Semitism?
Would I do the same thing again? Yes, I'd do the same thing again. I was sitting Shiva with the Rosenthal family when he was visiting, and I would still be sitting Shiva with the Rosenthal family. I traveled down to the arena to honor two of our police officers who were wounded, and we organized a ceremonial puck drop with the Penguins and the opportunity for them to watch that hockey game with their families. And then I went for an hour to celebrate my birthday with my family. Would I do those three things, or would I be there for the visit of the president? I would be with my officers. I would be with the family. I would be with my family 1,000 times out of 1,000 opportunities. We said to the president and to the White House came about on Monday when we were getting early indication that there may be a visit. This, they're not until 3 o'clock was the call that Secret Service would make with public safety, but we believed that there might be an indication. I had spoken with the president on Saturday. We had let the White House know that, you know, it would be difficult to have a visit during that past week on Sunday. On Monday, we let the White House know that it was not in the best intentions for Pittsburgh on a public safety basis to be there on that week, and especially on Tuesday, and the funerals would be happening on Tuesday because of the rules of the conservative part of the Jewish community, and that the funerals would all be completed by Friday. Even with that, there still is a period of mourning of 7 days after a funeral that is recognized, but it would be more appropriate to be there after Friday. We didn't get any word back, so we went to Senator Toomey. I personally texted the senator and said, please understand, we already have our officers on extra duty to be at the schools, at the synagogues, and all the critical places. I can't take them off of those areas in order to block every street between the airport and Squirrel Hill. You know, there's only so much we can do in an advisory role, and I do have an advisory duty to the president being on the ground here and understanding the public safety implications. At the end of the day, it's the president's call whether or not he decides that he's still going to come.
There have been many vigils to remember the victims outside on college campuses at Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall and Museum. Friday at noon, city is hosting a rally for peace and to honor the victims. Is this a time of transition from mourning to action, and what might that action be?
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I said this is not a mourning, although we'll mourn. This isn't a celebration, although we will sing together and we will celebrate Pittsburgh's ability to come together. So we've called it a gathering. And the gathering is a testament to what makes Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh. It's a recognition that even in the darkest day, there are rays of light that are able to shine through, and we highlight those rays. We let our Jewish community know that we are there for them and that we will be there for them in the future. And then we also reach out to all others that have been marginalized, either through words or who've gone through violence for decades. And we say to them, we are one Pittsburgh with you. And we look at this as that opportunity to start putting away the discussions about what makes us different, and we really highlight the part that makes us the same. So, yeah, it's a way to start that transition out of mourning, but we still mourn. Mourning's good. Mourning is leads to healing. Mourning is a necessity on a physical part of our body and definitely on our spiritual side as well. But we have to move beyond mourning, and that will be different for individual people and how long they take in order to do it. But on Friday, we're going to start to help people on that path.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. The aviation industry is facing a looming problem. Studies, including one from Boeing, show the demand for aviation maintenance workers will outstrip supply within the next decade. As part of legislation passed last month to reauthorize the Federal Aviation Administration, Congress created a $5 million grant program to fund a workforce development program aimed at boosting the number of aviation mechanics and technicians. 90.5 WESA's Maria Scapoletto visited the Pittsburgh Institute of Aeronautics that's helping to train the aviation workforce of tomorrow. Maria spoke with CEO Suzanne Markle about how the school can help the industry soar to new heights.
How is the aviation industry changing, and what does the PIA have to do as the industry evolves itself?
Well, the aviation industry is finally having to come to terms with this shortage. You know, for a lot of years, I think you've probably noticed as an airline passenger over the years, there used to be a lot of partially full flights. And now when you go to the airport, you know, the flights tend to be pretty darn full, and they're not running the flight unless it's a very good route. And so as the shortage of, you know, pilots and mechanics has become, you know, more at the forefront of planning, maintenance planning, and different activities, even though we have more passenger traffic, the flights have not increased in step. We're just filling those flights. Well, now the flights are full. We're hitting an impasse here. You can't cram any more people into that airplane. You're going to have more flights. And in order to offer more flights, you need more aviation personnel. And the aviation industry has finally said, okay, we cannot logistically adjust for this anymore. We need more people.
Why is there a shortage of aviation maintenance workers in the nation?
There are a lot of moving parts to the shortage as it exists now and as we are projecting into the future. One of the main factors is retirements that are going on in the industry right now. The average age of an aircraft maintenance technician is well into the 50s, and only 2% of current aircraft maintenance technicians are under the age of 30. So just by looking at the numbers there, you can see that there is going to be a large gap as the folks who are getting close to retirement are leaving the industry, and there are not going to be enough people coming into the industry to meet that gap.
You know, Congress responds with this grant program, and among other things, it's going to provide for scholarships, student outreach, veterans recruitment. How might the Pittsburgh Institute of Aeronautics utilize any federal money that's coming out of this FAA legislation?
Outreach is going to be the main thing. We have capacity to train students at each of our four campuses, and we are looking forward to having the additional support of industry and government and looking at some of the regulatory changes that can be made so that we can take more students who are interested in these STEM type of skills, hands-on skills, to look at aircraft maintenance as an option.
What are some of the jobs your graduates are landing, and where are they going after they graduate from maybe here at the West Mifflin campus?
Manufacturing facilities such as Boeing, Embraer. We also have maintenance, repair, and overhaul facilities, which are very plentiful across the country. Many of those facilities do maintenance for the major airlines, and then the airlines themselves, both the major airlines and the regional airlines.
Are people surprised that as a woman, you are the CEO of a trade school in an industry dominated by men?
Yes, I think it does surprise a lot of people to, you know, when they meet me the first time and say, wow, you know, this is unusual. And it really is in the aviation industry, being such a male-dominated industry historically, to see a female in charge of the school. But, you know, I think that one of my secrets to success is to let the aviation professionals do their jobs and give them all the support that they need in order to be successful.
What about the efforts to boost diversity, especially to bring maybe women into the industry? What do you think has been the hurdle to get over in that respect?
Getting the word out to prospective students who are females that this is something that they can do, that there is no problem, you know, as far as physical limitations or strength or anything like that that's going to be a deterrent, and that the industry itself is starved for diverse candidates, and the opportunities are so plentiful for female graduates.
What would you tell someone who maybe doesn't want to go to a four-year university but wants a family-sustaining career, may have never considered the aviation industry? What would be your pitch to that person?
I think my pitch to that person is, if you open the door to this industry and you take a look at what it offers, it's like the best-kept secret in our country in terms of companies with good benefits for its employees, opportunity for advancement, travel benefits. You know, the list goes on and on. It's really an exciting little part of society that a lot of people don't even know is there. And if you can get a good reputation in the aviation industry, you know, you can live anywhere you want. You know, in the country or even outside the country in a lot of cases. And you can really have a lifestyle that is not only, you know, family sustaining, but personally fulfilling. And you don't get that in a lot of other fields over the long term. Things in aviation always change. Things are always changing. They're always progressing. The technology is always being updated, and there's always a chance to learn. And I think that's what keeps us fresh.
Suzanne Markle, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Catholic dioceses across the country have been shrinking for years. Fewer families are attending Mass and giving donations. Fewer men are pursuing the priesthood. As a result, last month, the Pittsburgh Diocese began implementing its largest consolidation of parishes in decades. 90.5 WESA's Virginia Alvino Young reports on how the diocese got to this point.
Western Pennsylvania's Catholic population has a long history.
Wow, we can look back to the 18th century, if you want to go that far back, to the French fur trappers.
Paula Kane is chair of contemporary Catholic studies at the University of Pittsburgh. She says the Catholic trappers converged at Fort Duquesne, but it wasn't until the 19th century that Pittsburgh really grew through immigration. Enough Irish and German Catholics came that the Vatican established the Pittsburgh Diocese in 1843. It was among the first dioceses in the U.S. as the country expanded westward. Kane says there was a race to evangelize what was considered a mission territory.
And it was thought that this was a dangerous Protestant land in which the faith of Catholics would be imperiled. So the goal of the Vatican was to make sure Catholics did not, you know, leave their tradition and become Protestants.
It's towards the turn of the century through the 1920s that Pittsburgh sees its biggest influx of Catholic immigrants.
So that's when the steel mills draw in people after the Civil War. And we have lots of Poles, Italians, Slavs, Hungarians, Lithuanians, and so forth, who are all Catholic of different types.
Kane says in the early 20th century, Pittsburgh's working class was about 75% Catholic immigrants.
This growth phase involved the creation of a whole material infrastructure for the Catholic Church. So a rectory building, a convent building, a school building, a church building, a network of shrine and pilgrimage sites.
For a time, Kane says Catholics struggled to gain acceptance in Protestant America. They couldn't go to Ivy League schools and had a hard time finding employment and getting loans.
And I think that explains a lot of the pride that they had in their own parish world, their parish communities, the delight in seeing steeples go up against all these Protestant steeples that were there. You know, they really offered a symbol of Catholic power that was built in stone.
Around this time, there's also the establishment of Catholic universities, Catholic insurance companies, and Catholic labor unions. 66-year-old Marguerite Smith says she loved growing up Catholic.
It was awe-inspiring. And it was, you know, candles and organ and incense and Latin.
She's been a member of St. Agnes Parish in West Mifflin for 40 years. She says when she was younger, the whole world seemed Catholic.
It's all I really knew. I had an aunt that was a nun. It was very much a part of our whole life. You know, the Last Supper hung in the dining room, you know, there were crosses everywhere. And I was personal friends with the Blessed Mother, you know.
The families around her were involved, too. She says every kid in her class took First Communion and was confirmed years later. But these days, the folks helping out around the parish are the same ones who have been doing it for decades.
There are two of us that decorate the church for Christmas, for Easter. Now, we still put it in the bulletin. We're going to be here if you'd like to help.
Smith says in the last 25 years, the number of families in her parish has been cut in half. She tracks some of the decline back to the 1960s, when the Vatican attempted to make the church more contemporary and accessible. More power to the people, less Latin. Some people loved it, some didn't.
And it was slow. You know, it wasn't immediate. It wasn't like the next week when they made the first change at Mass that, you know, half the people didn't show up. Because people went, and it didn't look familiar anymore. So it started to seem not as important.
Around that time, there was another big change. A renewal of the prohibition against contraception turned off a lot of Catholics. Some priests and nuns left their orders. And by then, immigrant communities were more assimilated and affluent, and less involved in their parishes. In the meantime, all those costly stained glass windows and organ pipes still needed to be maintained. Smith's daughter, Marguerite Halden, is among those who hope to revitalize Pittsburgh's church. The 31-year-old is a go-to volunteer for fundraisers and events at St. Therese Parish in Munhall.
So we do the quarterly donut making, my husband and I together. So it's part of the youth and young adult ministry.
And that young adult ministry is pretty small. It reflects a saying you often hear around the diocese, that you see more funerals than baptisms these days. And there are numbers to back that up. In 1960, there were more than 24,000 infant baptisms in the diocese. A few years ago, there were just over 4,000. Mass attendance is down sharply, too. When the diocese started tracking it around 1990, 300,000 people attended. Now, that number is down by more than 50%. Halden says it's hard to compete with what she calls a me-centric society.
You know, it's like, what do we value on Sundays? We value the Steelers football game, and we value sleeping in, right?
And it's not just attendance in decline, but leadership. And the shortage of priests is only getting worse, with older clergy retiring. Halden says it was clear that something had to give.
For a lot of Catholics, in a sense, the writing was on the wall. We were seeing priests being really, really pressed for time. They were being split between multiple parishes. They were truly just unable to do the job that they were asked to do, being stretched so thin.
In the 1990s, former Pittsburgh Bishop Donald Worrell reduced the number of parishes by about 100. In 2012, current Bishop David Zubik continued that restructuring effort with On Mission for the Church Alive. It's a plan that places 188 parishes into 57 parish groupings. The idea is to create fewer but stronger communities.
You know, we looked at it as we want to revitalize our Catholic community. We want them to not feel like I'm this one person in this one church and there's no one else to help me.
And with half the parishes operating in the red, the new model also consolidates expenses. Halden was a member of the On Mission Commission. In order to advise the bishop, the group analyzed data and collected a lot of community feedback. Ultimately, the task was to put multiple parishes together, taking into account funding, geography, and culture. She says it was like solving a giant jigsaw puzzle.
Okay, if this is the new grouping, what will that look like? If this is a possible grouping, what will that look like? Also, what is the savings and the debt?
The changes coincide with the drop in approval by Catholics of how well they believe the church is handling widespread clergy sexual abuse scandals. Marguerite Halden says the On Mission Commission didn't focus on reasons why people were leaving the church.
But you also have to continually have this positive outlook of our goal is to revitalize, our goal is to make things better. So it's not that you're dismissing negative things that have happened within the Catholic Church, but you're looking at a bigger picture of how can we grow from this.
And while there were some mixed feelings throughout the diocese about the reorganization, its long-term impact on growth is yet to be seen. I'm Virginia Alvino-Young, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been nearly 30 years since the first DNA exoneration took place. Since then, there have been more than 360 others. A new Pennsylvania law could very well increase that number. Joining us now is Marissa Bluestein, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, which is based in Philadelphia. Welcome, Marissa.
Thank you very much.
Marissa, as I said, exonerations have been going on for three decades, but what will the passage and signing of Senate Bill 316 do?
There are two major provisions of Senate Bill 916 which will have a huge impact on those who are convicted of crimes they did not commit and are just looking for the evidence to be able to prove that in court. So the first major change for individuals is that even if you've pleaded guilty, you will be able to request DNA testing. And the second is that even if you have completed your sentence, you'll be able to request DNA testing. So on that first, with guilty pleas, we know that over 95% of all criminal cases resolve in a guilty plea. And yet we also know that innocent people plead guilty because for a variety of reasons. And we don't want to have those people prohibited from being able to prove that innocence in court if there's evidence available to do that. So this will lift that prohibition that Pennsylvania did have and bring us in line with the majority of states in the country.
You said that often there are confessions for a variety of reasons. Give us a sense of why somebody would confess, even though they might think that with DNA testing, that they could be exonerated of the allegations.
Sure. I mean, there are people who confess and even people who plead guilty to crimes knowing they didn't commit them. So when you speak to people who've been exonerated and who gave a confession to police, notwithstanding the fact they had nothing to do with the crime, very often what you hear is them saying, I just wanted it to end, that the interrogation process itself was so overwhelming that they feel like if they don't say something, then they are not getting out of that room. So we see that again and again and again. On a guilty plea side, very often we see them in the context of homicides where individuals are threatened with the death penalty and they enter a guilty plea in order to take the death penalty off the table. And there could be just people who are facing years and years in prison if they are convicted and are given a guilty plea option and they take that because they want to lessen the likelihood of a significant prison sentence.
One of the provisions of this new law allows people who have served a sentence to get DNA testing to overturn a conviction. Is this meant to clear their name, or is there something more to it, maybe in about how they feel about themselves or even how others feel about them?
All of that is correct. So for somebody who's been already convicted past the time when they've served their sentence, under Pennsylvania law, there really are no avenues available to clear your name, even if you know that you did not commit the crime, you know that you are innocent of the crime. And that in itself is obviously very problematic. But in the DNA context, right, when there's the potential for evidence which can scientifically prove this person did not commit this crime, you know, there was really little opposition from anyone that that person should be able to get access to the testing to be able to prove it. So in this limited context, we are going to be allowing people to get back into court even years after they've served their sentence if they can get that DNA. Now, it's important to remember that just getting the DNA doesn't overturn the conviction. There's still a whole other process that an individual has to go through. And then the second step would have to be the filing a petition in court to undo the conviction and have the charges withdrawn. But that does raise another, a very, very interesting and problematic issue. Even for our clients who have gone through court, some of them have gotten strong media attention, focusing on the fact that this person's innocent, they didn't commit the crime. There is almost always a continued stigma against that individual that, well, he must have done something because he wouldn't have been caught up in it the whole time if he weren't. Or he got over on the system somehow. And, you know, this person actually did commit a murder or a heinous crime, and now they're walking around among us, when you, quite the opposite is true. And frankly, in the age of Google, right, in the internet, there really is no such thing as completely erasing a record. So there are very deep psychological issues in terms of an exoneree coming out and, you know, having the acknowledgement that you were there, you shouldn't have been there, you were convicted, you shouldn't have been convicted, we know that you were innocent. That goes a long way to healing what they've been through throughout that whole process. And we hope that the changes will help to ease that for more people.
And it would also affect future employment, wouldn't it?
Of course, of course. Having a conviction, particularly of the nature that could be helpful, where DNA would be helpful, can be devastating for an individual to try to get a job coming out of that. So absolutely. So, you know, in terms of a procedure, if a person was able to get DNA testing and to show that they were in fact innocent, and then if they were to get their conviction reversed from that, the next step would be to get an expungement of that record from the court, which we certainly hope with our clients, but we hope would be very easily granted, to be able to at least take that legal stigma off their record.
Marissa, how greatly are your chances affected, the Innocence Project, of helping wrongfully convicted people now as compared to before the signing of this new law?
Well, certainly it opens up a whole new area of people to be able to reach out to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project for help. Before, if an individual pled guilty, even if there was DNA available that could prove their innocence, they were not allowed to get it. The court would deny it flat out. So now at least we have a fighting chance to be able to go into court and say, this individual deserves to have access to the very evidence that could prove their innocence, even more so for people who have completed their sentence. So we would certainly hope that anybody who is in that situation would contact us, because even with the law, as now more favorable as it is, it's still very complex and it's still very difficult for an individual to navigate those waters on their own. It really still does take a lot of expertise.
Marissa Bluestein is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, based in Philadelphia, with offices in Pittsburgh. Marissa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. No trial date has been set yet in federal court after 46-year-old Robert Bowers was held for trial after pleading not guilty to 44 counts in connection with the murders of 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue. David Harris is a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, and he's WESA's legal analyst. David, some people are wondering why Robert Bowers pleaded not guilty when he was captured at the synagogue and, according to witnesses, heard yelling his anti-Semitic reasons for the shootings. So why not guilty?
Well, you know, I've had that question a lot myself, Kevin. I think it does puzzle people why he would plead not guilty when we kind of know he did it. The answer here is that this is absolutely standard. It's absolutely routine. There are types of cases, tend to be very, very much less serious cases, in which a person will plead guilty right at the first appearance or the preliminary hearing just to get the case behind them, get out of jail if they're incarcerated, get back to work. That does sometimes happen. But for any case in which the stakes are high, we do see that the people would plead not guilty and simply take the case from there. It doesn't mean that the person cannot plead guilty later on. It simply means that for right now, they're putting down the marker as not guilty.
David, do you plead not guilty now in the hopes that maybe you can get the death penalty off the table in negotiations and say, if that happens, then I'll plead guilty?
That's certainly one particular strategy that you could see being used here. What they're basically doing in this case is saying, we're not ready to plead anything definitive yet, so the safe thing to do is to plead not guilty, just get the case rolling, see what develops, and then see if they can get the death penalty off the table or get any other kind of concession. If they simply pled guilty now, none of that would be in play. There could be no deal. He'd have to plead to the charges, and those do include capital sentencing, a death penalty.
And you're not going to plead guilty if the prosecution is seeking the death penalty. You force them to prove it, right?
Well, exactly. That's the whole point here. There's an old saying that the proof beyond a reasonable doubt must come except if you plead guilty. And if you plead guilty, you're basically giving up your right to insist on the state proving its case against you. Here, the state, of course, we mean the federal government. That's everybody's right. They have to, the federal government, that is, has to come with the evidence and prove guilt, not just assume it, even in a case where it seems very, very likely that the finding would be guilty in the end.
So have you been hearing from people maybe asking, why are we, the taxpayers, paying for Bauer's defense, a public defender?
Yes, yes, yes. I've heard this many times. Why are we giving him a lawyer? Why are we paying for a defense? This is going to be so expensive. Why the massive police investigation? We know what happened. And I that's a natural question. I understand why people ask it. But we really do this not for him, not for Mr. Bauer's, but for us, because we believe in a thorough and complete investigation. Because if we, our police officers, our prosecutors, have to go ahead and prove the case in the end, we want to have all of our ducks lined up perfectly so we get that proof and we don't have it overturned on appeal. And most importantly, we don't do this because somehow he's deserving of it or something like that. It isn't done for him. We do it actually for us, because those are our values, due process, fairness, and so forth. Very much not his, but that's irrelevant. We want to act in consistent ways with our values, with what our system holds up as the best that the legal system can do, even in the case of a client who's about the worst kind of person you could imagine. We do it for us because this is what we care about.
So it's not necessarily for the system, it's for the citizens.
Oh, that's right. The system and the citizens, I would say. The citizens of this country, everybody deserves to have the Constitution followed, even when it's most difficult for us. And let's face it, this is a terrible offense by what looks like a really terrible guy. But we do it for him because it's important to us as citizens of this country. We value the things that the legal system can do when it works right. And so we do it because we want to feel in the end we gave this person every shot. Even if they aren't the kind of people who would do that for other people, we do it because it's important to us.
Do I assume that the U.S. Attorney's Office wants a vigorous defense by the public defender in the Bauer's case so that there's no chance that any conviction could possibly get overturned?
Oh, yes. That's a big concern for everybody involved. I mean, you could think that, maybe the prosecutors would want no lawyer at all, or would want maybe somebody who would just take a very soft position in a case like this so they get a conviction. But you have to understand two things. The prosecutor's job is not just to get a conviction, it's to do justice. And number two, that you have a much better chance of having whatever conviction you do get stand up on appeal when you have good lawyering on both sides, not just on your own side. We have a lot of death verdicts in this country over the past 20, 30 years that have been overturned, and overwhelmingly, the thing that gets them overturned more often than anything else is poor defense lawyering. Judges appointing lawyers to death penalty cases who have no business doing that kind of work, who have no experience or very little experience with it at all. And those are the lawyers who end up getting into trouble with these cases, who don't know how to do them. Then the case is overturned. That isn't in anybody's interest. It's not in the prosecutor's interest. It's not in the victim's interest. It's in nobody's interest. So the best situation is if you can have a vigorous defense where you get every guarantee that the defendant got all the rights that he or she is entitled to, you get a verdict, and that verdict is defensible on appeal. If you're a prosecutor, that's really what you want.
No trial date has been set yet. The case has been signed to Judge Donetta Ambrose. What might we expect in the meantime?
In the meantime, there will be a series of pretrial skirmishes. Some right out front, there will be motions filed, things like that. And then some will be behind the scenes. There will begin to be discussions about whether there's any arrangement that everybody could accept in which the defendant could plead guilty for probably the lifting of the death penalty. Maybe the answer to that is no. Maybe it's yes. We have to find out. Of course, the statements and wishes of the victims will be considered, but they won't be the thing that govern. In the end, it's up to the prosecutors to decide what kind of case to go for, whether to offer a plea of any kind, and how to go forward. Once we get those initial discussions and those things out of the way, we'll inch toward trial, and experience tells us that as we get closer and closer to the date, it will concentrate the minds of everybody involved, and there can be negotiations up to the last minute of the first witness being sworn.
David Harris is WESA's legal analyst, and he is the host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. David, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Kevin.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5. Next time on The Confluence, Sunday marks the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, Armistice Day, which became Veterans Day. We'll visit with Pittsburgh area veterans about challenges and opportunities, plus a talk with award-winning multimedia artist Christiana Leach. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistant from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.